From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Farai today. Barack Obama spends the week meeting with key Middle Eastern leaders, has this international tour given him commander-in-chief credibility? And is John McCain about to announce his pick for vice president, or is he dangling that carrot to keep his name in the headlines while Obama is getting all the ink? Here to give us their perspectives on the campaign news of the day, we have Democratic strategist Donna Brazil. She is an author and a nationally syndicated columnist. And Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying group DC Navigators. Ron is also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Hello, both of you.
Hello, Tony.
Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you back again. Today, Barack Obama has been meeting with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, as we know. Earlier in the week, he met with Iraqi leaders and U.S. military officials. A great deal has been said about the trip, his positions, whether they've changed, and what impact this made for the campaign event is having on voters. So, Ron, let me start with you. Give him a grade so far on all of the above.
Well, Tony, I think I'd give him two grades. I'd give him a grade on substance, and I'd give him a grade on overall qualities to be commander-in-chief. On substance on the trip, I think I'd give him a C. He has looked very good, no question about that, talking with world leaders over in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Israel. But the question remains whether or not he has the experience and he has the temperament to be commander-in-chief. And on that, I'd give him an incomplete. Just because one goes over and has a series of meetings with world leaders does not suddenly make them filled with substance and stature that qualifies them to be the commander-in-chief. I'm very concerned about Senator Obama's inconsistent statements regarding the troop withdrawals in Iraq. He refuses to say that the surge that the commander-in-chief George W. Bush and General David Petraeus put in place that has reduced violence dramatically in the region. And finally, Senator Obama, I believe, is trying to score political points when he's with our troops, and the most important thing that we need to do is to continue to find a way to wage and win a war on terrorism rather than using our troops as a photo op and a backdrop for his political ambitions.
Let's follow up on that point, Donna Brazil, because I'd like to ask you two things. First, does it hurt Obama's credibility to go on with a plan that is not in line precisely with General Petraeus' direct recommendations, bearing in mind, of course, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, said just yesterday in a PBS interview that some of what Obama is saying with regard to the need for troops elsewhere, specifically Afghanistan, was true, and that they had to come from someplace, presumably a drawdown in Iraq. And he even went on to say that, or he intimated that, a drawdown could begin this fall, depending on what happens on the ground. So does that mean that everyone is becoming closer together?
Well, yes, there's a consensus that's now being formed, not only by Senator Obama, who's shown great leadership and great temperament throughout his travels abroad, but there's also a consensus being developed here. I mean, President Bush is now calling for a time horizon. He's recognizing not only the success of the surge, and let me just say, as a Democrat, we have the best military force in the world. And the fact that our troops are performing well under very difficult circumstances is a testament to not only their training, but also their desire and commitment to finish the job. I think what Senator Obama has tried to do on this week-long trip across the globe is to, one, listen to leaders in the region to get an assessment, with the conditions not only in the Middle East, but also to hear from our European allies on what they would like to see happen. And this is not just about the surge. We're now in a post-surge Iraq. What's the plan? The Bush administration and John McCain, who seems to echo everything that comes out of the president's mouth, do not have a plan, a post-surge plan, to ensure that not only is the Iraqi forces prepared to take over, as they have done now in the southern part of Iraq where the British has left, but more importantly, what's the future? They have elections scheduled later this year. The Iraqi leaders, including the Sunnis, would like to see the American forces out. It may not be a date certain, but it's a time period because they're ready to step up and lead their own sovereign nation.
One of the things that has happened with regard to this trip, we have moved from Iraq into Israel, where Obama held a news conference just today, Ron. He answered the questions. My question to you is, did he seem less confident about his answers this morning than he does when he's discussing the war or the economy, let's say?
Well, Tony, I think he does. I think he has continued to evolve in his knowledge of foreign policy matters. He's been in the Senate, I think, for 163 legislative days. He's now the chairman of the subcommittee on the Foreign Relations Committee that deals specifically with Afghanistan, but yet this was the first time that he was in Afghanistan. He's shown more of an aptitude with that part of the world, but I think he continues to struggle and grapple with how to deal with Jerusalem. Should it be a divided capital? Should it be a united capital? How to deal with the existence of those in the region who do not want the Jewish state to exist, who want to eliminate the Jewish state as it currently exists? How does one negotiate from a position of strength with those who are trying to diminish, if not destroy, one of America's strongest allies in the region? So looking at his press conference and some of the coverage I've seen earlier today, I do not think he sounds as confident as he does on other issues. But again, his confidence is almost unnerving for someone who has such a lack of foreign policy experience to purport to demonstrate such a substantive knowledge.
You know, Ron, what's so interesting in all of your analysis about Senator Obama's perceived inexperience is the so-called experience and judgment that has put America in such a weakened state militarily, put America in such a weakened state economically. You know, the talking points that the Republicans are using about Senator Obama are just flat out old recycled material. Senator Obama has shown not just that he's comfortable talking about these issues, meeting with Israeli leaders, but he's also thoughtful and engaging in listening to Mr. Benjamin
Netanyahu.
Yes, he's meeting with the defense minister. The purpose of the trip is to gain insights and information from those on the ground, to talk about the economy over there, to talk about the crisis, to talk about Iran. And I saw the same press conference where he appeared very confident about what not only he's learning, but also, again, making a serious commitment to strengthening U.S.-Israeli ties, supporting Israel. He has been a firm supporter of Israel. So I don't think there's any discomfort. I think what Senator Obama's goals this week was to go and meet these leaders and to learn and listen, unlike some of people we know that may travel overseas but don't listen to anyone.
Well, let's use this opportunity to move to the third part of our discussion in the time that we have left, because it's important, and it has to do with, you talked about purpose, Donna Brazile, and the purpose of the trip for Barack Obama. The purpose this week for John McCain might be described quite differently. News was brewing that he might announce his vice presidential candidate this week in an effort to minimize the media frenzy that has been circling Barack Obama on his trip overseas. He's made no such announcement and yesterday said, quote, "We will announce when we are ready to announce." My question to you, Ron, is does this sound like McCain has already made up his mind on a running mate but just isn't saying so? What's he doing?
I'm sure he has. I'm sure he has settled to one or two people who he thinks could best help him lead the country. I think Senator McCain's problem right now is he's trying to find a way to be relevant. He's not had a very good series of weeks and a good series of events in the last couple days and weeks. And I think Senator McCain is trying to find a way to remain relevant and to stay in the news. Senator Obama, there's no question, has been the force that has sucked all the oxygen out of the room. And Senator McCain is trying to find a way to make himself visible to the American people so that his message still counts. The last thing I'd say, Tony, to my dear friend Donna Brazile, the question as it relates to Senator Obama is, it's a very earnest question that I think the American people deserve an answer to. He is very thoughtful. He is very charismatic. He is very telegenic. But it's a question of experience. And just because someone has been in the Senate for only a handful of years does not suddenly make him experienced, Donna. But I don't take anything away from his thoughtfulness or his ability to connect with people. So, again, Senator McCain is fighting an uphill battle,
Tony. Well, he's had more experience in government, be it state and federal government, than the president who is now serving this country.
No, he hasn't. You can't point to one specific measure he signed into law.
He can't name one accomplishment, Donna,
that he has in the Senate.
Who backed the Earned Income Tax Credit in Illinois. And in the United States Senate, he has been a leader working with Mr. Lugar on ending nuclear proliferation. He took the lead in the Congressional Ethics Reform and Congressional Lobbying Act.
But can you tell me one bill
so
that he's authored that's been signed into law.
That is a law. That is a law out there in congressional reform.
Let me jump in. Let me interrupt.
John McCain has 32 years in Washington, D.C., and let me just say this. While John McCain and his Republican allies are complaining about the media coverage, this is a guy who once said the media was his base, and any presidential candidate would give their left arm to receiving the kind of coverage that John McCain has received from the media over 10 years. Again,
now, let
this
me,
is all
I've
got to
break
great.
In. I've got to break in, Don. I've got to break in because our time is running short. That's all right. We like to have conversations like this, and we enjoy having the both of you on because we know that's what you're going to do. But I do want, in less than a minute, to get some sense from either of you who you think John McCain is going to select. We've heard the name Jindal from Louisiana. We've heard the name Pawlenty from Minnesota, the governor, because of that being a battleground state. In 30 seconds or so, John, do you have any sense of who he might pick and who the Democrats would want him to pick? I know. This was for Donna. I was asking Donna.
Sorry. Yeah. I thought you were asking Ryan.
No.
Look, first of all, I think it's all blue smoke and mirrors. I mean, John McCain is so desperate these days that he's using old recycled talking points from the Clinton primary fight with Obama. I don't think he's settled on anyone. I think there's a short list. I think Mitt Romney is likely on that list because he would bring a great deal of economic expertise that Mr. McCain won't have to outsource to others.
Well, let me ask Ryan to jump in really quick.
He has some other good choices in terms of governors.
Ryan, you've got less than 10 seconds. Who do you think?
Governor Mitt Romney would be the long shot. The dark horse would be former OMB Director and U.S. Trade Representative Rob Portman, who is very strong and from Ohio, economic and trade experience.
I appreciate both of you, Donna Brazile and Ron Christie, both joining us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C.
You need to bring a whistle next time.
I guess you're right about that.
Exactly.
Thank you both. Just ahead, you ever been called Cornelius as a black man when that's not your name? Coded racism creeps into the workplace, and it's a topic for our bloggers. Plus, polygamy. It's not limited to sect leaders like Warren Jeffs. We'll talk about polygamy in the black community next.
Now, from unscrupulous lenders to home finance that follows religious principles, Islamic finance firms in the U.S. work with customers to help them buy homes without compromising Islamic values. As NPR's Jamie Terabay reports, the firm's conservative approach to finance has kept them and their customers clear of the subprime drama.
Khaled Akbal's brand new condo sits in one corner of a quiet leafy square in the Northern Virginia suburb. He's 62, and it's the first home he's bought in the U.S. since moving here from Canada. Some of his neighbors are under foreclosure, but that's not happening to Akbal because he didn't take out a high-risk loan.
I've always bought everything, all the big things on Islamic financing, or make sure, my wife makes sure I pay all my bills on time so that there's no interest involved in it and everything.
Here's how it works. Islam forbids charging interest in the belief it exploits people, but making money off actual goods is okay. So Akbal worked with an Islamic finance company to buy the $300,000 condo he shares with his wife. He put up $30,000, they put in the rest. And instead of paying a mortgage, Akbal will pay rent until eventually he buys the company out of its share. The company charges a fee for Akbal's exclusive use of the house, but considers that profit, not interest. It'll end up costing practically the same as a mortgage, but the methodology is what's different.
You have essentially the same type of product.
Hossam Qutb is from Guidance Financial, one of these Islamic finance firms. He uses the analogy of a potato chip fried in pig fat and one fried in something more acceptable to people who don't eat pork.
It's a potato chip. The difference is the method by which they produce this product. The cost of those two potato chips potentially could be the same on the shelf at the grocery store.
Some of the Islamic financial groups have been around in the U.S. since the beginning of this decade. Qutb says his company initially focused on the most devout Muslims. Now his group closes on average 100 contracts a month. But they're very careful about who they do business with. Potential buyers need to give more up front, have a good credit score and savings.
If that customer cannot qualify for a home, then that person should wait. And we do turn away, a number of folks because of that. We've always been, like I said, very conservative in our criteria for qualification.
Qutb says business is up 13% in the first half of this year. The Islamic finance industry itself is rather small, between $2 and $3 billion a year. That's a drop in the bucket, says mortgage finance expert Guy Sakala. He says the market for alternatives to traditional lenders is growing.
The traditional mortgage market, as we know it, is on its knees. So a lot of individuals who want to buy a home now or whatever are going to have to look to some of these more locally based lending sources.
In Khalid Akbal's Virginia condo, 2-year-old granddaughter Asya is ready for a nap. And Akbal says he sleeps easily too, knowing he hasn't violated the principles of his faith to buy his home.
As far as I'm concerned, I'm very happy that I took this step and the way that I did it. And I sleep well.
Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
For cycling fans, the Tour de France is both a magnificent challenge and a chance to get to know some new parts of the country. This year, 180 cyclists are following a route that's more than 2,000 miles, passing through hundreds of towns and villages along the way. And there's twice the excitement this year, as Anita Elash explains.
With its 12th-century cathedral and picture-perfect setting in the southern French Alps, the town of Amprun welcomes tens of thousands of tourists every year. But this weekend, it's bursting at the seams with visitors who have come to watch as the Tour de France leaves for two of the toughest mountain climbs in the race. Nearly every hotel room in the region has been booked for months. At the Saturday morning market in the sprawling town square, merchants like fruit vendor Sophie Pianfetti are doing a booming business.
Merci. Passez une bonne journée. Merci vous aussi.
Her sales are up more than 30%.
Nous on est installés depuis 7h30 et depuis.
We've been here since 7:30 this morning, and since 8 we've been overwhelmed, she says. People are preparing picnics to go watch the Tour de France, so it's been a very good market day. Amprun last hosted the Tour de France 34 years ago. This year, there are two stages starting from Amprun, the first time that's happened in the Tour's 95-year history. The Tour has taken over the town. The roads have been repaved and Amprun is festooned with balloons, flags and paper hearts, all in the Tour's official color, yellow. The local busker is raking it in from the crowds of cycling fans, and even the traffic circles and streetlights are decorated with French flags and multicolored bicycles. André Rouny, who works at the local sewage plant, has made a special effort to show his support for the Tour.
C'est une combinaison de travail.
Rumi lives right at the start line. He spent 3 days building straw replicas of cyclists dressed in the yellow leader's jersey, green stage winner's jersey, and polka dot best climber jersey, and attaching them to his house.
C'est-à-dire que quand on va voir les coureurs monter un col ou machin.
When you see them climbing hills and in the mountains, that's one thing, but it's nothing like this, he says. Having them start right outside my house twice is really exceptional. It's something I've never seen before, and I will probably never see again. The residents of Amprun have stayed loyal to the Tour de France, despite the doping scandals that have plagued the event. They hope the extensive television coverage of the Tour's two departures will draw international attention to their town and bring even more tourists next year. But not everyone is thrilled to see the cyclists pass through. All the roads have been blocked off, and local resident Pascal Godefroy says she had to park her car half a mile from her home. The days of the race, I have to leave for work 2 hours early, just so I don't interfere with the Tour, she says. It's just too much. The competitors climb their highest peak today. Then they'll leave the Alps and head for Paris and Sunday's finish on the Champs-Élysées. For NPR News, I'm Anita Elash in Amprun.
The face of Army medic Joseph Dwyer became known to the American public in the early days of the war in Iraq. In 2003, he was famously photographed putting his life at risk to rescue an injured Iraqi child.
Private Dwyer didn't see himself as a hero. He knew his personal failures. He struggled with them for years. Joseph Dwyer died late last month in Pinehurst, North Carolina. As Rose Hoban of North Carolina Public Radio reports, he left his comrades also scarred by war.
Late last month, Joseph Dwyer made his last call for help. Police say when they kicked open the door to Dwyer's home in Pinehurst, North Carolina, he was still alive, but he was having trouble breathing. Pinehurst Police Captain Floyd Thomas describes the scene.
The house was in disarray and we hadn't been cleaned in a long time. There's been some incidents where he had punched holes in the walls.
Dwyer died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. His death has been ruled an accidental overdose. He'd been inhaling aerosol chemicals from cans of compressed air. Captain Thomas was familiar with Dwyer. He had responded to a number of calls to Dwyer's house starting about a year ago.
We got a call that he was barricaded in his residence. He was hallucinating about there being Iraqis in the house and wanting to call in airstrikes and that sort of thing.
Thomas says he had no idea this was the soldier from the famous photo until he looked Dwyer up on the internet. Warren Zinn is the photographer who took that famous picture of Dwyer. He says Dwyer was embarrassed about the attention.
Joseph felt there were thousands of other soldiers doing exactly what he did. It just happened to be that there was a photographer in front of him that made his moment more noticeable than others.
Dwyer stayed in touch with Zinn by email over the years. Later, he wrote to Zinn that his work as a medic was the best thing he'd ever done. That kind of attitude endeared Dwyer to his fellow soldiers. Roderick Houston of Chicago served with Dwyer as a medic in the 3rd Squadron, 7th Cavalry.
He was just that epitome of that really wholesome, innocent, I just want to help the world, I want to make the world a better place kind of person.
When the two served together, their squadron met enemy forces earlier and more often than any other unit at the beginning of the war. Fighting was intense, but Houston says everyone knew they could count on Dwyer.
You could sit back and just kind of watch his mannerisms and watch the things that he says and just have like that kind of American apple pie thought in your head, like this is what I'm fighting for, you know.
Houston didn't know Dwyer was having problems after coming home until he heard about his death. But he says he isn't surprised. Houston is 100% disabled with post-traumatic stress disorder. Another former comrade contacted for this story says he has nightmares during the day. Both men told NPR that many former soldiers from their units struggle with PTSD and depression. So did Dwyer, who was on disability from the VA. He drank. Sometimes neighbors heard screaming from the little ranch house where Dwyer lived with his wife and daughter. Post-traumatic stress was dogging him, according to his neighbor, Philip Sweet, a Vietnam veteran.
He asked me how I coped with it, and I explained to him that I was in Vietnam early on, and it was before it got really bad, so I didn't probably experience a lot of things that he may have.
Veterans Administration officials say Dwyer cycled in and out of VA hospitals up and down the East Coast. Dwyer disappeared from the neighborhood. He told Sweet he was going for treatment. And when he returned last summer, Sweet says his neighbor seemed better. But it didn't last.
It wasn't too long after he got back that his wife and child moved out, and he just kind of became almost a total recluse. I saw him just a few times to speak with him.
Dwyer wrecked his motorcycle and then his car. Eventually, his contact was limited to the cab driver who came almost daily to take Dwyer to the store, where he bought food and cans of compressed air. By the time he died, he was inhaling chemicals from more than 10 aerosol cans a day. Since learning of his death, Warren Zinn, the photographer, says he's been thinking about Dwyer a lot.
Joseph just happens to sort of represent all of these soldiers who are suffering with the same problems, because these soldiers are trained to go to war and they're trained to fight, but they're not trained to come home from war.
Joseph Dwyer was buried at a veterans cemetery in North Carolina. He leaves behind a wife and 2-year-old daughter. He was 31. For NPR News, I'm Rose Hoban in Durham, North Carolina.
let's go next to England, where bishops of the Worldwide Anglican Church are meeting. This meeting of church leaders comes once every 10 years. It's called the Lambeth Conference, after the London Borough and a palace where early meetings were held. The big news is who didn't come this time. About a quarter of the bishops, mostly from Africa, Asia, and South America, are boycotting. It's a dispute over the role of women and gay people in the church, as Vicky Barker reports.
Paul Handley, managing editor of the Church Times, sits in his London office sorting clippings from the mainstream British press. Many predict the breakup of the Anglican Communion. Back in the 1860s, when the Church Times was founded, he says, vicars who controversially put lit candles on their altars were often attacked by mobs from neighboring parishes.
The ritualist priests would have their own mobs, and the police would be called in, and so it was a hugely rambunctious time.
In other words, Handley says, the Anglican Church has been here before.
It ought to be possible in a Christian context to have both the rows and the reconciliation going on at the same time, but we're human beings, so it doesn't really work that way. But I think open warfare is not necessarily a bad thing. This is how theology is done.
Put that way, theology is definitely being done at this Lambeth Conference. Several of the traditionalist bishops refused to take communion during the colorful inaugural mass in Canterbury Cathedral. Other liberal bishops participated and then also attended a separate service hosted by an Anglican gay and lesbian group. The guest of honor was the openly gay Bishop of New Hampshire, Gene Robinson. Robinson wasn't invited to the three-week conference, a concession to the hardliners, which failed to head off their boycott. He's come to Britain anyway, as a walking reminder, he says, to his fellow bishops.
Every single one of them have gay and lesbian people in their pews, and they've taken vows to serve all of their flock, not just certain ones.
But it's the people in the pulpit, not the pews, who are the subject of such controversy. Gregory Venables helped organize an alternative gathering of Anglican traditionalists in Jerusalem last month. He says he's heard little at the Lambeth Conference to reassure those convinced that the Bible forbids ordaining women or practicing homosexuals as bishops.
The faithful of a few years ago are now the dissidents of today, and that's a tragedy. And that's why we believe we're at the end at the moment.
Yet the traditionalists don't appear to speak for all conservative Anglicans. At Holy Trinity Church on London's upmarket Sloane Square, the congregation is asked to pray for the bishops attending the Lambeth Conference. With its professional choir and incense-swinging celebrants, Holy Trinity is very smells and bells, as the Brits would say. It is firmly on the Catholic end of the Anglo-Catholic tradition, from which many of the traditionalists sprang. But on the issues causing such anguish within the Anglican Communion, Holy Trinity's clergy are deliberately silent. Over tea, one of them, the Reverend Graham Rainford, says he parks his personal beliefs about homosexual clergy at the church door, just as he did when women were first ordained.
I mean, people knew where I stood, but never once did I preach on it, other than around it, about issues of how do we discern the will of God within the church. I mean, I think it's quite legitimate for a preacher to talk of that, but not say, you know, and this is what we ought to believe.
In some ways, this dispute is not so much about sex as about power. The hardliners think the Archbishop of Canterbury should crack down hard on national churches which try to make ancient teachings accommodate modern mores. Those boycotting the conference are threatening to create a parallel church within a church which will wield that kind of authority, among themselves anyway. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
Back now with Day to Day, the Batman sequel, The Dark Knight, broke box office records this last weekend, no surprise there. But the critical acclaim is more than most people expected, real raves for Heath Ledger as the Joker. As critic Andrew Wallenstein says, that means an opportunity come Oscar time.
When the Academy Award nominations for Best Supporting Actor are announced next year, I'll bet anything Ledger will be among them. Critics are practically tripping over themselves to praise his chilling portrayal of Batman nemesis, the Joker.
Why don't we cut you up into little pieces and feed you to your pooches? And then we'll see how loyal a hungry dog really is.
That a comic book character is generating Oscar buzz seems a little strange. The awards are traditionally dominated by so-called prestige pictures. These are typically art house dramas, high on artistic integrity, but low on box office receipts. And that could be one reason the ratings for the Oscar telecasts on ABC each year have been in a death spiral, 2008 being the lowest yet. After all, why should a mass audience feel invested in films most of them have never seen? Like, say, last year's Oscar darling, Atonement.
Yes, I saw him.
Just as you see me.
I know it was him.
You know it was him? Well, you saw him.
But here's the thing about Ledger. He's not the only one in a popcorn movie this time of year that gave a great performance. So perhaps it's time Oscar voters start to reevaluate just what their standards are. I mean, let's face it. There is an elitist bias on the awards circuit against movies that make a lot of money. It wasn't always this way. Titanic and Lord of the Rings were huge Oscar winners in their day. But now it's as if quality could not possibly exist within a film intended to drive quantity. But I don't think many people see the two as mutually exclusive. Take, for instance, Robert Downey Jr.'s work in another mega-successful summer film, Iron Man. It's worthy of a Best Actor nomination. I don't think the film was all that good, but his individual performance was as good as any I've seen this year.
It's an imperfect world, but it's the only one we've got. I guarantee you, the day weapons are no longer needed to keep the peace, I'll start making bricks and beams for baby hospitals.
You rehearse that much?
Every night in front of the mirror before bedtime.
Should Downey be disqualified from contention because he happened to spend a portion of the film flying around in a metal suit? I hope not. If metal is a deal-breaker, that could also bode badly for WALL-E, the animated tale of a lonely robot. WALL-E is probably the best movie I saw this summer. Every year, Pixar seems to produce top-notch movies that only get noticed in secondary categories. But isn't it high time for a Best Picture nod? Hell, I'd settle for a secondary category like Best Screenplay for Judd Apatow, the writer-producer responsible for just about every great comedy the past 3 years. He was ignored for The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up. Can we get him something, anything, for Forgetting Sarah Marshall or Pineapple Express, just two of the comedies he's attached to this year? Of course not. Oscar seems blind to anything but drama, though I'd pit a great comedy like Knocked Up, or even a great action movie like The Bourne Ultimatum, against anything nominated in recent years. Mainstream movies are capable of achieving a quality worthy of Oscar recognition. Maybe it's time to do some recognizing, if for no other reason than saving the Oscars from obscurity.
Andrew Wallenstein is a deputy editor at The Hollywood Reporter.